Section 2, North Carolina in the War for Independence. As you read, look for Actions of the Provincial Congress and Committees of Safety in North Carolina. Purposes of the Mecklenburg and Halifax Resolves. Important innovations in the state constitution of 1776. Early battles between Whigs and Tories in North Carolina. And the following terms: Provincial Congress, Committees of Safety, Tories, Whigs, Mecklenburg Resolves, Halifax Resolves, Declaration of Rights, and Confiscation Act. Even before the battles of Lexington and Concord, North Carolinians had taken steps to separate themselves from the control of the British. When first Governor Tryon, then his successor, Josiah Martin, tried to shut down the assembly, Speaker John Harvey continued to correspond with protesters in other colonies. Harvey, who was elected 5 times as Speaker of the Assembly, stood up to the royal governors for the interests of North Carolinians. In 1774, Governor Martin refused to call the assembly together to elect representatives to attend a Continental Congress. The Congress was meeting in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to protest what was going on in Boston. Harvey set up a new body, a Provincial Congress, which chose the delegates anyway. When news of the battles at Lexington and Concord arrived in North Carolina, Governor Martin fled. Harvey ordered committees of safety to be set up in each county to keep order and provide government. Most committees immediately demanded that men suspected of siding with the British, called Tories, had to sign a loyalty oath. In turn, members of the committees called themselves Whigs, a name borrowed from the political opponents of the Tories back in London. The Committee of Safety in Mecklenburg County went farther in protesting the British attacks than any other. Mecklenburg's leaders came together at Queen's Academy to discuss recent events. The committee announced a series of statements that have collectively been called the Mecklenburg Resolves. The resolves stated that, because of British aggression, the King's commissions were null and void. Local leaders were directed to elect new leaders themselves. As cheering residents realized, this amounted to Mecklenburg being free and independent of British authority. Later, Mecklenburg residents counted their years of liberty from 1775 and what came to be called the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence. The date it was said to have been signed, May 20, 1775, was later included on North Carolina's state flag. According to legend, James Jack, a Charlotte tavern keeper, took copies of what the Mecklenburg leaders had done all the way to Philadelphia to show them to the Continental Congress. The Battle of Moore's Creek Bridge. After the death of John Harvey in 1775, other leaders like Cornelius Harnett of Wilmington and Richard Caswell of Kinston led the province. The Provincial Congress set up defense measures, created a loyalty oath for everyone to take, authorized the enlistment of soldiers to fight in the war, and printed paper money to pay for everything. The province raised 2 regiments, groups of soldiers, commanded by James Moore of Wilmington and Robert Howe of Brunswick. Both later became generals in the army. North Carolina militiamen, civilians called up to serve the military for short periods of time, were sent into South Carolina and Virginia to fight Tories. By early 1776, North Carolinians were once again fighting among themselves, this time about the war against the British. Governor Martin had fled to a ship off the Cape Fear coast. Nevertheless, he encouraged the recently arrived Highland Scots to march on Wilmington to join a British invasion of the 2 Carolina colonies. Since many of the Highlanders had signed an oath of personal loyalty to the king, they kept their word and gathered to fight. In February, the Highlanders marched from Cross Creek toward Wilmington. Colonel James Moore ordered several groups of militia to cut them off. The Whig forces blocked the Tories' path at Moore's Creek Bridge, about 20 miles north of Wilmington. The Whigs removed the planks from the bridge and greased the support beams. For 15 minutes, the Highlanders tried to slip and slide across the bridge. More than 50 were shot. They soon retreated. Colonel Moore chased them, seizing their arms and money. the Battle of Moore's Creek Bridge was as celebrated an American victory in the Southern colonies as the 1775 Battle of Bunker Hill had been in Boston. Halifax resolves. The British attempt to rally support convinced many North Carolinians that their conflict could not be settled peacefully. William Hooper, a delegate to the Continental Congress, wrote that it would be Toryism to hint at the possibility of future reconciliation. In April 1776, the Provincial Congress decided that the whole province should follow the example of Mecklenburg County. Independence seems to be the word, Robert Howe told his friends back in Brunswick. On April 12, 1776, the Provincial Congress passed the Halifax Resolves, which put together all the feelings about liberty and freedom that North Carolinians had been discussing for years. This is the second date on the state flag. The resolves authorized the delegates in Philadelphia to join other colonies in seeking independence. North Carolina became the first of the 13 colonies to endorse the independence movement. Later, in July 1776, William Hooper, Joseph Hughes, and John Penn were the three North Carolinians who signed the Declaration of Independence. Within months, the great document was read publicly in front of every courthouse in North Carolina. The ideas expressed in the words of Thomas Jefferson were familiar to many North Carolinians. King George III, Jefferson claimed, dissolved representative houses repeatedly, which reminded them of the troubles of the regulation. The king's policy of imposing taxes on us without our consent had been the basis for the protests over the Stamp Act. Most of all, Jefferson ended the Declaration with the promise that Americans would mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor, a phrase that was taught at Queen's Academy in Charlotte and which was part of the language used to construct the Mecklenburg Resolves. State Constitution. Once independence was declared and the United States created by an act of the Continental Congress, North Carolina officially went from being a colony to a state. As a state, North Carolina had to come up with its own rules to govern itself. With the encouragement of the Continental Congress, each of the 13 new states wrote a state constitution, a set of rules and procedures for government. To make sure the new government truly connected to the people, the Provincial Congress chose delegates for a special constitutional convention. The delegates wrote the first state constitution at a convention in Halifax in November and December 1776. Everyone who wrote the North Carolina Constitution agreed upon one principle: the legislature, made up of the representatives of the people, should be the strongest part of the government. They continued the General Assembly, but made it bicameral. The House of Commons, an old English term for people who were not aristocrats, and the Senate, an old term that went back to ancient Rome, referring to older, wiser leadership. Each county in the state was to send two delegates to the House and one to the Senate. The representation was equal no matter how big or small the county was, whether in size or population. House members had to own 100 acres and senators 300 acres, a way to ensure that only wealthier men were elected to the higher of the two bodies. All eligible men could elect a House member, but only those who owned at least 50 acres could vote for senators. No women or slaves could vote at that time. While North Carolinians gave a lot of power to the General Assembly, they kept watch on them. All General Assembly members were to run for office on an annual basis. That way, unhappy voters could replace them frequently or reward them often. Because North Carolinians remembered vividly what a leader like William Tryon could do to them, they were cautious in the creation of the office of governor. He was to be chosen by the legislature each year, and he had very little power. The governor could only act upon the advice of a council and the consent of the legislature. William Hooper joked that the governor's only real power was to sign a receipt for his salary. Most importantly, North Carolinians included a Declaration of Rights in their constitution. This list set out the rights and protections citizens had, such as the right to a trial with a jury. The Declaration of Rights was a legacy of the Regulation and the other controversies with the British. It was written by the delegates from Mecklenburg, Rowan, and Orange counties, the very places where people's rights and property had been literally trampled. Amazingly, the delegates included no rule about amendments to the Constitution. Governing the new state. The new legislature in the new state faced many challenges in its early years. Under the first governor, Richard Caswell, it had to find ways to protect its citizens and raise revenue to pay for the war. Waging a war is expensive. Soldiers must be paid. Ammunition and weapons must be purchased. Also, soldiers must have food, clothing, and shelter. There is a need for wagons, horses, ships, and more. In 1777, the Assembly passed a Confiscation Act, which said that residents who refused to take the oath of allegiance to the new state could have their property taken away. Eventually, the lands of hundreds of North Carolina residents were seized, including the thousands of acres still belonging to the descendants of Lord Granville. With each seizure, the state made money by reselling the land. In addition, strictly religious people like the Quakers and Moravians, who would not say an oath or take up arms, had to pay more taxes than other citizens. One of the major expenses was the raising of troops to fight in the Continental Army. North Carolina sent several regiments north to fight with General George Washington in 1777. Some of these troops fought bravely at the Battle of Germantown, just outside of Philadelphia. General Francis Nash of Hillsborough was killed. He would later be remembered in the naming of both Nashville, North Carolina, and Nashville, Tennessee. The state's troops had to endure the harsh winter of 1777 and 1778 at Valley Forge, Pennsylvania. By the end of the war, more than 7,000 North Carolinians had served in the Continental Army. Divided loyalties. Although the principal enemy in the War for Independence was the British, none of the original 13 states was more divided in its loyalties than North Carolina, most likely because the issues of the recent regulation were so fresh in the minds of many residents. Many coastal residents sided with the Whigs. They had been the ones most affected by British restrictions on their access to trade. In the West, the most enthusiastic Whigs lived in Mecklenburg and Rowan counties. There, the Scots-Irish vented their traditional hostility to English control over their lives and property. Many soldiers in the first regiments sent to the Continental Army came from these two areas. Tories were concentrated in the central area of the state, often in the neighborhoods that had supported the regulators, like the Forks area in what is today's Davie County. Many of these residents still resented what the people on the coast had done to their homes and communities. It was not so much that ex-regulators loved the king, rather they hated the leaders of the coastal area more. Some regulators who had fled to the mountains, such as those who settled on Mills River near today's Hendersonville, felt the same way. The strongest group of Tories remained the Highland Scots in the Sandhills, who continued to quietly support the king even after their defeat at Moore's Creek Bridge. Although North Carolina was relatively unified in the early years of the war, there was Tory activity. In 1777, state officers put down a Tory plot to capture guns and ammunition at Halifax and use those guns to kidnap Governor Richard Caswell. The same year, Tories drank to the king's health at a secret gathering in Guilford County. About the same time, dissatisfied residents of the Uwharrie Mountains marched on Cross Creek to demand that salt be sold at a reasonable price. In 1778, hundreds of men who refused to take the oath of allegiance to the state were charged four times the taxes paid by other state residents. When some of these men refused to pay their taxes, greedy Whigs seized their lands, often to punish them and earn more money at the same time. Some of the Native Americans in the state saw the War for Independence as a way to regain their lands. In the spring and summer of 1776, the Cherokee attacked along the frontier. The state sent backcountry militia over the Blue Ridge to attack the Cherokee. Dozens of Cherokee towns were destroyed, including the sacred town of Nikwassee, near the present town of Franklin, and many of the Cherokee were left hungry and homeless. The measures the new government took against the Cherokee and the Tories kept the state safe and relatively secure for the first 3 years of the war. In 1779, however, the British invaded the southern states again, and this time North Carolina was almost destroyed. Special feature: Carolina Places, Halifax. During the War for Independence, Halifax may have been the liveliest town in the new state. It certainly was the most important in the year 1776, when North Carolina became the first state to go on record urging the colonies to seek independence. Later that same year, the new state's leaders returned to write the first state constitution. Lord Cornwallis later camped there as his British army moved toward Virginia and disaster at Yorktown. Halifax was founded in 1757 to handle shipping from nearby plantations on the Roanoke River. Halifax remained very small in the colonial period because most of its prominent citizens lived outside of town on their plantations. People from all around the area, however, came to town to have parties, watch horse races, attend the Church of England, and hold the county court 4 times a year. During the War for Independence, Halifax made uniforms for North Carolina Continentals. The best-known early residence was Willie, pronounced Wiley in the speech of the day, Jones. A successful tobacco and wheat planter, Jones threw the biggest parties in town. He kept some of the fastest racehorses and had his own private racetrack. Jones had a hand in the passage of the Halifax Resolves in April 1776 and became acting executive of the state during the time between the Declaration of Independence in July 1776 and the writing of the state constitution in November. He then had a major role in the writing of the North Carolina Constitution. During the War for Independence, Jones went to Philadelphia to be a member of the Continental Congress. Jones' view of liberty was very strict. He believed no government should be very strong. When it came time to write the United States Constitution in 1787, Jones opposed the idea of a strong federal government. He refused to represent the state at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia and then worked to keep North Carolina from ratifying the Constitution in 1788. His last public act was to help establish the site for the capital city, Raleigh. Historic Halifax is now a state historic site within the small town of Halifax. The state has restored a number of buildings to depict life in the early history of the town. The best known of the buildings is the Owens House, built around 1760. The Constitution Burgess House was, at one time, thought to be where the first state constitution was written. However, later evidence shows that the Constitution was actually written at the Eagle Hotel. After the Declaration of Independence was passed, Halifax was one of the first places in the state where it was read aloud. Townspeople carried members of the assembly on their shoulders in an impromptu, unplanned and unorganized, parade. Halifax did not grow very much in the 1800s. It particularly lost influence after the railroads helped develop Roanoke Rapids. In the 20th century, it remained a small county seat town in the northern coastal plain.